Welcome to this podcast produced by Imagine, your resource for early childhood music therapy. Imagine is produced by Della Vista Publisher and can be found on the web at www.imagine.musictherapy.biz. The title of this podcast is Adaptive Music Making for Meaningful Inclusion and features Jessica Corwin and Jennifer Kass in an interview with Dr. Petra Kern. Hello, I'm Dr. Petra Kern, the editor of the Imagine magazine. Welcome to Jessica Corwin and Jennifer Kass. Thank you for joining me today on this Imagine podcast. As music therapists, we sometimes have to think outside the box to create successful music therapy experiences for children of all ability levels. In this year's Imagine podcast series, we would like to find out how you make music accessible to young learners, what kind of adaptations you make or assistance you give, and in which ways this support transforms the participation and engagement of your clients. Here are 10 questions for you. My first question is, tell us, where do you work and what is your role?
Well, I am the music therapist, one of the music therapists on staff at the music school. And in my capacity with AMP, I am taking my music therapy toolkit and I'm going into the classrooms to help make the music more accessible to the kiddos. So I am, I believe we're all called teaching artists. Mm-hmm. Is that what it is? Yes. So I'm not doing music therapy when I'm in there, but that's the background that really makes what I do possible.
And Jennifer, AMP stands for what? And I have to tell our listeners that I did a cold call because I found them on the internet and they have really a fantastic program. So what does it stand for?
Well, AMP is the Adaptive Music Program, which is a program within the Community Music School of Springfield in Massachusetts. I'm also a teaching artist and I'm the director of the program. And I have a very different background from Jen. I'm a licensed music teacher and I taught music in the public schools in Massachusetts for 15 years before I switched over to AMP. So AMP provides several services to students in Springfield and the Springfield area. But the core of what we do is that we get grant money to send teaching artists, including the two of us, into the public schools to work with students with disabilities. Sometimes those are inclusion classes where students with disabilities are in a classroom with typically developing peers. Normally for us, that's a preschool classroom. But Springfield is so large that they also have a program of sub-separate classrooms where students with similar disabilities, mostly autism with really high support needs, are in their own classrooms. So most of what we do is going into the public schools to work with those sub-separate classrooms.
So what everyday situations come to your mind when you hear about adaptive music making in early childhood settings? Do you have some examples from your inclusion practice?
Yes, absolutely. When I first came in, my role was actually a little bit different. I wasn't doing primary teaching. I was supporting other music teachers who suddenly had students who they were familiar with, and then new students brought right in who have all sorts of different special needs, and they didn't have the training for this. So I was kind of on-site training and troubleshooting with the students who were there. And a lot of the times, the more difficult it is to communicate, that's sort of where my troubleshooting brain turns on and I start bringing in switches and buttons and tools and different ways to try and sort of leveling the playing field, because music is such, as a music therapist, you know, it's such a great place for everyone to be on the same page. You can have teachers and paraprofessionals and students who are verbal, students who are not verbal, all able to participate in the same activity.
Let's continue with this inclusion thought. In what way can adaptive music making support access and then a sense of belonging for the young children?
I definitely think this is a place where sometimes the children who have been in these classes who haven't had a voice, you know, if other kids are choosing what the song is going to be, they may need a visual representation. They may need to pick a card from something or record it on a button so that they get to have a voice that is still their choice, but they're able to be the ones who physically make it happen.
Right. And you talked about the button already. And do you have any other tips about how to adapt instruments or then music lessons?
There are some things that just, I've been a practicing music therapist for over 20 years. And sometimes I've had people who wanted so desperately to hold a maraca, but had low muscle tone and would drop it. And even if they could almost hold it. So I would take just a hair scrunchie, not the elastic bands, but the ones that have a lot of fabric around them. And you can wrap those around. And all of a sudden you have someone who can just shake their arm and do it. That was my favorite find, was you take a glove from the dollar store and you glue a shaker right onto it. And then even if their arm is just hanging down and they move it a little bit, nothing's going to fall off there. That glove is on. And so having ways, lots of Velcro, so much Velcro, and having things physically attached. I would love the idea of a tray that actually was almost like a steel drum in that it has different sections. And then you could just clip it onto somebody's tray. And then they can, if they're able to, they can use a mallet to hit them. But for now, what I do is I do use drums that have little feet on them. And we're just really careful about who gets what instrument. If we're doing a drumming activity and you have someone who can only move one hand and not the other, you make sure it's a drum that can be held up on its own. And then the kiddo who does have movement in both their hands can use the one that they have to hold with one hand or tuck it under their arm.
See, this is what I mean about creativity and think about the box. And you sound like an endless resource of ideas and how to adjust instruments for your clients.
I do make a lot of the supplies that I use. I actually, you know, I would love to show you. It's an arm's reach, but we can describe it.
Yes.
I crochet. And if you can hear that, they are river rocks. It means that it's heavy. And it's an octopus. Sometimes kids need things to help ground them. And if we can have an activity where they're passing something that is heavier, or that they can shake it or toss it without hurting anything.
All right, let's look into our question number 5. How have you meaningfully used assistive technology?
I use a lot of buttons and switches, and I have an app that I use. I know that many more have been made since then, but I actually had a family member who codes make me an app so that I could have song choices and instrument choices. And so they would push the button and then it would say the name of the song.
So Jessica, how do you build the foundation of musical elements with children of all abilities? Meaning, how do you adapt the music foundations to young children where we actually don't use notation and all that?
Oh yeah. So building that foundation is like an absolute prerequisite to learning notation, which is why the entire focus from ages 0 to about 7 typically is on building the foundation, which specifically is building your ability to sing on pitch, you know, have a sense of tonality, learning to keep a steady beat and discern rhythms, and also developing your sense of musical expressivity, what makes music cool, you know? So the general way that we help children develop those skills is through play, through musical play, where they think they're just playing games. They don't know that they're learning. That play is always an excuse to do lots of repetitions of something. So that play might look like things like simple games, like, you know, Ring Around the Rosie, or finger plays like the Itsy Bitsy Spider, could be something like freeze dance, all sorts of, you know, similar kid-centric musical activities. It often involves a lot of singing because we want kids to be able to replicate that play outside of class when they don't have instruments. However, in AMP, the Adaptive Music Program, many of our students are non-speaking, which means in many cases they don't sing, or at least they don't sing improvisationally. Some of them engage freely in musical echolalia, or echoing musical fragments or entire songs. That's kind of a cool form of stimming. It helps them to process what they're hearing or soothe themselves, and it can help them make social connections. So our students may or may not engage in more traditional preschool music class activities. Sometimes they need nonverbal ways to engage, like by playing instruments or doing movement. Sometimes they need hand-over-hand assistance. Sometimes they can be full participants in a musical activity with the use of a choice board or choice cards to help them contribute ideas. By the way, just one thing I wanted to throw in is that with autistic preschoolers, we prefer to use cards so we can offer just two or three choices at a time, as opposed to a full choice board menu, which can be really overwhelming. The really important thing is that these kids are meaningfully included in a classroom community that's engaged in playful music making, whether or not they're creating music every time themselves. I recently got to observe a colleague who did an echo song from Ghana with a class of entirely non-speaking children. So she sang the song and the school staff echoed it back. None of the children had the skills to do that at that time. And it was just really beautiful to see that every one of those kids smiled at the song finale every single time. Kumadende, hey! And the kids are grinning. They weren't actually making the music themselves. You know, it's sort of contrary to how I was trained as a music educator, where, you know, we want kids to be making the music, but clearly they were musically engaged and they were part of that classroom community doing that and sharing that experience. And I just felt like there was so much dignity and love in how those wonderful educators were creating a live and relatable musical experience that they could all enjoy together. So that was an interesting departure from my training as a music educator.
Yes. And what you have already said leads into my two next questions. And the next one would be, how do you adapt songwriting for young children? And you gave actually already an example how the children fill in the words. That's one way of songwriting, right? With the hey. But what else are you doing?
Yeah, so I had the privilege of studying with John Feyerabend, who created a method of teaching early childhood music called First Steps in Music. And this is one of the things that he teaches. He calls it arioso, his process. Kids are really often natural songwriters because you do hear them singing to themselves, you know, if they're singing to like narrate their activities or if they're changing words to familiar songs. So he's got a system for sort of nurturing that over the course of months or years. So the way that I've been doing it, I've been adapting his methods. I start with a wordless improvisation. And because it has to be playful, I will put some sort of animal figurine or stuffed animal in their hand. And I'll ask them to howl like a wolf or sing like a whale or hoot like an owl, something that gets them to switch into their flexible voice for singing. And once they're doing that, they've got the animal sound, then I'll ask them to do it in pairs with another classmate, and they have to take turns to make it a conversation. So they're starting to develop a sense of form. My turn, your turn, my turn, your turn. And you ask them to do it expressively. So maybe their owl is excited, hoo, 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 or maybe their owl is sad, hoo, hoo. And so that is helping to build that foundation. That's the start of building them up to some songwriting. Then, like you said, we can have them fill in words and songs. But then the top level, which is my favorite, and kids ask for it all the time once we start it, it's got to be playful, right? So using imagination, I bring in a dragon puppet. And my dragon, she's got a whole character, a whole persona, where basically she's an anthropologist. She's learning about human children, but she only understands you if you sing. So she'll come in and she'll sing a question. What did you have for breakfast today? And they have to sing their answer. So we'll hear cereal, pancakes. You know, we go around and it's a very short answer, but they get so excited about the dragon that I start asking more and more involved questions, and they sing longer answers and they are improvising, which is age-appropriate songwriting.
Yes. And you are so engaging that I want to come through the screen right away and sing with you. So
our
listeners, you should see the two of them. They're so engaging here on the screen, which is wonderful. You mentioned an African song, which brings us to question number 8. How do you adapt music making to children's culture and heritage?
Yeah, so this is another really great question and one that deserves so much more examination than we can really fit into a podcast. One really tangible aspect of working toward a culturally inclusive and responsive music classroom is the selection of music and who it represents and whether students see themselves reflected in the music that we choose. Because whatever we share with them, they understand inherently that that's what we value. So if we leave kids out, we're communicating that their background is somehow less important, even if that's not what we mean to say. Most of us weren't originally taught to do anything other than center the white experience in music class. So the first and very necessary step is to use music that lets all of our students see themselves reflected and valued and celebrated. That means using music that reflects their cultural identities as closely as possible. So when we take surveys or, you know, we're doing government demographics, we've got categories that are really broad: Black, Hispanic, White, Asian. But that's not good enough in the music classroom to make sure that kids see themselves. So if I've got a student who I know is Latinx and their parents immigrated from Mexico, they're probably not going to see themselves in a song that I choose that's in Spanish. But it's about a frog from Puerto Rico. Like, it's not. So I need to match my kid's identity as closely as possible.
You're bringing up excellent points, Jessica. What is your top advice for adaptive music making early childhood settings?
Top advice.
Yes.
Connecting with the teachers and the people who know these kids the best, and getting as much information as we can from them so that we can come in ready to, you know, I always say troubleshoot, but ready to figure out who they are and how we can bring the music to them.
And I would say, for me, the top advice is just to watch the children. That is sort of a mantra that I got from Dr. Peggy Bennett, who got it from Mary Helen Richards, and has never steered me wrong. Watch the children, see how they're responding, and adapt to them.
Finally, what are your resource recommendations?
So we have a YouTube channel for the Adaptive Music Program, which is linked from our website, communitymusicschool.com. Go to the Adaptive Music Program and you will see the link to our YouTube channel. We've got dozens and dozens of videos of activities that you can do with children, particularly children with disabilities. And if you come back to the website in hopefully mid-May, fingers crossed, we're going to have a sort of crowdsourced by our team book of other classroom activities with all of the adaptive elements provided. So we'll have choice boards included. You know, here's a song and here's the choice board that you just need to print out, and instructions for how to do it. So we will also have written resources on the website, hopefully come May.
That sounds wonderful. We certainly will include this on the podcast webpage so that our listeners have access to your resources as well. Thank you very much for your insights and sharing your energy and your love for working with young children. You really can feel it in this podcast interview. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to this Imagine podcast, produced in 2023.